I am Sylvie Légère. I'm the co-founder of the Policy Circle. And I am pleased to welcome you today to today's conversation call, discussing the lessons that we can learn from Venezuela and its socialist policies. The Policy Circle has recently published a series of four posts that are taking an in-depth look at Venezuela's past and present. And if you haven't already, I invite you to review this series, which is available on our blog at thepolicycircle.org. So joining us on the call today, I'm really excited to discuss with our guest, Juan Gonzalez. Hello, Juan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Juan is Associate VP at the Cohen Group and a Senior Fellow at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. Juan spent 16 years of government service focused on Latin America and the Caribbean with the State Department, the National Security Council, and the Office of the Vice President. Also with us is Katia Rimkunas. Hi, Katia.
Good afternoon.
Katia is Regional Deputy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for IRI, and Katia brings more than 14 years of experience in international political development and democratic governance. And finally, Emilio Pacheco is joining us. Hi, Emilio.
Hi.
Hi. Emilio was born and raised in Venezuela, where he lived until 1987 and was a professor at the Catholic University in Caracas. Emilio now serves as president of the Liberty Fund, and his views here are solely his own. And we really appreciate Emilio sharing with us his personal experience. And this whole idea of the case study on Venezuela really came from a conversation that Emilio and I had earlier this year. So grateful to have you on this call. I also want to tell everyone that my co-founder, Angela Brawley, recently interviewed Emilio, and a recording of that interview is available also on the Policy Circle blog. So welcome, everyone, and really thank you for taking the time. The way this will work, we'll have a conversation with Juan, Katia, and Emilio, and then we will open up the phone lines for questions from our callers. So at any point during this call, you can ask a question. If you want to ask a question, please press 5-star, and you will be added to the queue. And you can do this at any point. So let's start. So, Katia, so I'm going to start here with Katia. Let's start us off with some background information on what you've seen transpire in Venezuela over the past 10 years. Maybe you can give us an explanation of how socialism has played out in Venezuela and its impact on democracy.
Sure. Good afternoon. And first, thank you again for giving me the opportunity to participate in this call and be with you all this afternoon. So what we have seen over the last 20 years in Venezuela is really an experiment that I would say has frankly failed. The experiment was started and led by former President Hugo Chavez, who came into power in 1999. Now, he called his program and his government the Bolivarian Revolution, and really placed it under the banner of socialism, basing it on various social principles. The idea resonated with a lot of Venezuelans at that time who had been largely forgotten by the then political class and had not seen the benefits of the wealth of the state. Chavez promised social transformation through the socialization of the economy, which to a certain point, again, he delivered. He used the oil boom to create social programs that were directed at some of the poorer sectors in Venezuela. People loved him for it. In the long run, however, what Chavez ended up creating was not a socialist government, but an authoritarian one, where power was centralized in the executive and a chosen few. Over the 14 years that Chavez was in power, he led the complete breakdown of the various democratic institutions in the country and gravely mismanaged its economy and production sectors. Chavez and his government failed to make some of the country's wealth and invest in its economy and domestic production. Instead, he and his government gravely mismanaged the wealth. he was able to do this in large part because Venezuela's democratic institutions were already weak when he first took office. And they were really unable to provide a check and balance on his efforts to centralize control and power in the executive. In a healthy democracy like the one we live in, there are checks and balances present, as well as strong institutions that prohibit any one individual or small group of people from centralizing that decision making and that power. I'll leave it at there.
Okay. Well, Juan, what's your take, you know, on this perspective and the Venezuela is viewed as kind of the poster child of socialism, and also the difference or its impact on democracy.
Sure. So I think, I mean, you could. And first of all, thank you for having me. So it was a great opportunity to talk about this issue. I always learn when I talk about it and receive questions from folks that are following it. But I think you could blame socialism for the problems in Venezuela. I think you can blame men who, in the search of power, took what was one of the breadbasket of Latin America, one of the richest countries in Latin America, and brought it down to the ground. I mean, Katia is exactly right on everything that she said. You know, Hugo Chavez, when he rose to power, it was really a result of the traditional democratic order in the country was breaking down. The traditional parties in the country were seen as very corrupt and is really not delivering benefits to the people. Chavez came in very charismatic, made a lot of promises, and he was by all assessments, a very populist and charismatic leader. Once in power, he blurred the distinction between government, party, and the state to destroy the political order, undermine the country's institutions, strengthen his own personal authority, and it sought to replace capitalism with his so-called 21st century socialism that traded representative democracy for a system of so-called participatory democracy where he went directly to the people. But it really was, in effect, something that it was to centralize his own power. And in practice, what he did was he went after the press by prosecuting journalists. He closed down TV stations, harassed regional media, concentrated government advertising with friendly media. He even went after the private sector by nationalizing industries. He even went after the power of the church by shifting government funding for social health and school programs toward his own organizations. And challenging the independent curricula of church-run schools. And then finally, I think what I would say is initially it seemed to work because he assumed power when oil was at a very high price and the poverty rate fell from 49% to 27%, unemployment dropped from 14 to 7. But what he was doing below the surface was bankrupting the country. And then when he finally passed away in 2013, the successor, who came to power under a questionable vote, inherited a bankrupt country, and they have been essentially since trying to just hold on to power even though the majority of the population wants change.
Yeah, thanks, Juan. You know, Emilio, I'd like to ask you your take and, you know, what you saw as kind of the warning signs that perhaps Venezuelans missed about the impact of Chavez policies early on. You were there, and maybe share with us a little bit of that, what was happening and what was missed and what are the warning signs that all of us should be on the lookout for these types of shift in a government becoming a more of a totalitarian government.
Well, thank you again. Thank you also for having me. The first thing that we need to start with, and I think that mentioned this, is that Venezuela is an oil country, and it has been an oil country pretty much since 1928. Most of the foreign exchange comes from the sales of oil, and before Saudi Arabia came online in the 1960s, Venezuela was the main world exporter of oil. The idea that Venezuela was a wealthy country, Venezuela is a country that has had a lot of income coming from the sale of oil, but it also has had a very volatile economy. So the first thing to say is that socialism in the Chavez incarnation has roots in what I would call state dirigism, that was actually has been the policy, the economic policy in Venezuela pretty much since the 1950s. What made the Chavez project different was, and he announced it pretty early, were two things. One was his participation in the failed coup d'etat, his disregard for the institutions, and his threat that he would overwhelm, or he would override the institutions as they existed. One thing, actually, that Juan mentioned, when Chavez takes power, oil prices are $9 per barrel. And Chavez, it needs to be recalled, was actually ousted for about 3 days in the early 2000s. The unhappiness and unrest in the country were very, very high. It's only when oil prices go up than his popularity rises. But again, it's very difficult to know how many of the elections, that of the many elections, or many referenda that Chavez organized, how many of those, I would say, maybe the first one or two, were actually cleaned. When the head of the Electoral College becomes Chavez's vice president, and today is actually Maduro Minister of Communications, it's very difficult to judge whether Chavez was, or the regime in general, was democratically elected. So the warning signs were there. Shortly after he left prison, Chavez went to Havana. He gave a very lengthy speech there, and when he came back to Venezuela, he announced that his aim in politics was to bring Venezuela, and I quote, to the sea of happiness of Cuba. Of course, he was only able to do that after the oil prices went up. And yes, there was a period of bonanza, but that period had periods like that existed before. In the 1950s, it was a huge bonanza under a dictator, Marcos Perez Jimenez. In the 1970s, there was a huge bonanza under a democratic president, Carlos Andrés Pérez. After that, of course, there was a long period of economic crisis. Chavez actually comes into power because oil has been exhausted at the time. I mean, again, it's $9 per barrel as the main source of wealth of the country.
Great, thank you. So thank you guys for just kind of explaining just the rise of Chavez and its policy and its impact. Tasia, you know, based on the time that you spent on the ground in Venezuela promoting democracy, can you share with us how opposition leaders have long tried to fight for their democratic rights and what's different this time around? And also maybe you can help us understand the types of efforts and activities that organizations like IRI and NDI in conjunction with the U.S. government are doing to stem the negative impact of the former Chavez presidency and the current Maduro presidency?
That's a great question. So the evolution of the opposition movement in Venezuela, I think, is quite a story to tell and highlight, because it is, I think there's a lot of lessons learned, good ones and frankly bad ones, that a lot of other opposition movements in similar conditions could learn from. The political opposition in Venezuela was largely divided for a very long period of time after Chavez was initially elected. I think a couple of my colleagues here touched upon the few of the moves and strengths that Chavez had and took during his time in power to centralize power and to frankly also divide the opposition further. As I had mentioned before, the traditional political class in Venezuela was largely discredited when Chavez was first elected due to their inability to really address citizens' most pressing issues, particularly those of the poorest sectors of Venezuelan society. Chavez did everything in his power possible to further weaken the political opposition throughout his time in office. And for a long time, he was really successful. I think a lot of political egos oftentimes get in the way of the opposition parties and actors working together and really being able to coalesce to counteract some of Chavez's efforts and moves. I think this was largely the case until, I would say, around mid to late 2000s, when a group of political parties and actors started getting together to discuss citizen priority issues, such as insecurity, and what were then kind of thematic roundtables. You know, what they saw was that they couldn't necessarily agree on kind of political actions, but they can at the very least start to discuss, you know, what were some of the issues that they could maybe focus on. These discussion tables evolved to what today we know as the MOOT, or the Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is an electoral coalition of opposition political parties who were able to, over a number of years, finally serve as a stopgap of sorts to Chavez and then Maduro's centralization of power. The important lesson learned here, I think, is that, you know, one political party or actor cannot be the sole source of change when confronting an authoritarian regime. It really took the opposition years to finally understand, I think, and more importantly, act on that and put aside, to a certain degree, personal egos and agendas. Once the opposition found unity and success with that unity through elections, they have since then, I would say, made it a priority to maintain that unity. Now, the opposition in Venezuela now has really evolved to be much more than just political party or MOOT opposition. There's a broader opposition made up of different civil society actors, different sectors, who are coming together to the extent that they can to fight for a democratic change. Now, you know, I would say despite all the challenges that the broader opposition continues to face currently in Venezuela, they are still very much committed to the extent possible maintaining unity, because they know that all these different sectors and actors and political parties together are stronger together than they are individually or by sector. Now, since Maduro has taken office, like I was saying, the political opposition has been, and the broader opposition has dramatically grown. And I think, again, this has been key to be able to not only advocate for democratic change inside the country, but also outside. And again, their common goal continues to be to bring about that democratic change inside the country. And now, more than ever, attend to the humanitarian crisis that we see. Shifting a little bit to IRI, to the International Republican Institute in which I work, our mission globally is to advance democracy and freedom. We do this by accompanying democratic actors in the countries in which we work in their journeys to build democratic societies. So we have long worked with democratic partners throughout the Latin American and Caribbean region. We currently have programs in 15 countries in the region, and in countries such as Venezuela, we work with democratic actors to safeguard whatever democratic space there may be left and advocate for democratic change. Thank you.
Thanks, Katia. So Juan, can you tell us from your experience, you know, building on what Katia said, what about the conversations and actions that were taking place in the White House and the State Department with regard to Venezuela over the past decade? And is there anything that you think the U.S. should have done differently along the way, and or perhaps some lessons learned going forward in helping the opposition really form a strong democracy going forward in Venezuela?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to go through some of this quickly so we can go to present day. But what I would say is, kind of building on what Katia said, is that one of the key ingredients to Hugo Chavez's success, as well as the success of any kind of strong man trying to centralize power in the region, has been that you need an international enemy to distract from the situation in the country. And for a long time, that was the United States for Hugo Chavez. So he would pick fights with the U.S., and it wouldn't allow for the Venezuelan people to get a space for other regional leaders to come out and criticize and put a spotlight on what was going on in the country. And it wasn't until the second term of the Bush administration when there was a shift in approach. And rather than I'm gonna quote Lyndon Johnson here to kind of define the policy. Lyndon Johnson had this saying where he said, "Never wrestle with a pig because you get dirty, but the pig has fun." And so that was the approach to Hugo Chavez during the second term, which was, don't wrestle with a pig, but rather point out the violations of human rights, the politicization of the military, the mismanagement of the economy, and work with others to make sure that there's a coalition to start pressuring and putting a spotlight on the situation. Our ambassador at the time, Ambassador Brownfield, what he did was he went straight into the strongholds of Hugo Chavez to show that the U.S. wasn't a boogeyman and to, you know, say that the U.S. actually was also in favor of supporting reductions to poverty, but in a democratic way. This approach continued under the Obama administration. And I think the change that took place under the Obama administration was one where we needed to build a regional consensus to do something about Venezuela. So we started talking to governments that didn't like us, would include Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, not because we expected them to all of a sudden change their ideology, but because we wanted to dispel this notion that the United States fostered hemispheric polarization. And by doing so, we created a space for countries like Colombia, Peru, and Mexico to play a greater role in the regional conversations. I think one of the biggest challenges that we face, and Katsu referred to this, was that is that the opposition was actually very divided during this time. And when Hugo Chavez died in 2013, Nicolas Maduro took over, he was very weak. But when we would travel to the region and meet with regional presidents, I was working with Vice President Biden at the time, they would say to us this. They would say, we don't know which opposition we're talking to, because one day we have one delegation that visits and is very democratic and wants a democratic transition. And then you have another opposition representative that fits the next week that is very undemocratic. And so I think in some ways the opposition hurt itself in those beginning, I think, years of the Maduro administration. That, of course, as Katia mentioned, changed significantly when you have Juan Guaido, the National Assembly president, who for the first time was able to unite the opposition. Today, I think the international coalition of 50-plus countries that do not recognize the results of the May 2018 election that led to the re-election of Nicolas Maduro, which was a completely robbed election. They didn't even try to hide it. And the international response to pressure Venezuela toward a democratic transition has really been, I think, led primarily by the opposition. Now, in the U.S., I would say where we ended in the Obama administration is we started moving toward greater sanctions, but we at that time lacked that international kind of coalition, and we lacked the united opposition to be able to create almost a tipping point against what had become a dictatorship in country. I got to recognize, and I'll be brief here, is the Trump administration, I think, has done some really great things in that they initially came out with a very aggressive set of sanctions against individuals. And by and large, right now, I think in the United States, U.S. policy toward Venezuela is one that has been bipartisan, supported by Democrats and Republicans. And that, I think, is also a result of what the Venezuelan opposition has done. What could we do differently? And I'll close with this, is that I think particularly as it relates to U.S. policy, it is very difficult to – sanctions are difficult because it's easy to sanction individuals who in Venezuela have stolen at least $300 billion from the government treasury. That's money that we know of. But to do a broader sectoral sanctions that have a potential impact on the Venezuelan people is something that, regardless of where you do it, is very difficult to do, because what you're doing is you're putting pressure on the government. Eventually, you will actually start punishing the economy and making things worse. And I think that's where the bipartisan consensus in favor of Venezuela starts to break down. Where I think we could be doing things differently is I think that the U.S. right now is being as aggressive and their sanctions regime is as robust, I think, as it can be. The countries of Latin America and the countries of Europe, though they have publicly recognized the Guaido government as the only legitimate democratic institution and have called Nicolás Maduro as a dictator and a usurper, they are not actually implementing a robust sanctions regime. So I think what I would do differently is I would press regional governments in Europe to try to duplicate what the United States has done and make sure that the people that are in government right now, which are robbing it blind, even though people are starving to death, that they're not able to hide their money, that they're not able to vacation. Right now you have very wealthy families of those who are in government that have robbed it blind that are, you know, living in beautiful mansions in Italy and even in Miami. And so there's got to be a broader diplomatic sanctions regime to close any sort of avenue or relief to the current regime.
So that's really interesting. There needs to be really a international kind of concerted effort to impact this regime. So and that kind of leads us to this conversation about what can informed citizens in the U.S. can do and what could they say to their representatives in Congress. So I'm wondering, Katia, if you could share, you know, with people on the call here, what can they do to maybe voice what you and what Juan just said to their representatives or maybe local representatives? Share a little bit there, and then we'll turn it over to Juan and Emilio and then open it up for questions.
Sure. No, that's a great question as well. Before I jump into that, though, I do want to highlight one thing that Juan mentioned, because I think there is an interesting differentiation understanding of the Venezuelan opposition that I think is important to know, just in terms of how, again, kind of oppositions in different these types of environments operate. The success of the Venezuelan opposition, in particular the MUD, the political coalition, was because they were able to unite, again, under kind of their broader goal of democratic change and transition in the country, but primarily because they were able to coalesce around elections. So that's why I said it, they were an electoral coalition, and that's what they did best. They kind of got the point that, one of the ways that Chavez maintained power and stayed in power was through this democratic facade, if you will, of elections. And even though, you know, there were issues and there were definitely issues with the electoral system, they were still to a certain degree competitive. And so they were able to coalesce around those times of elections, which frankly, you know, in Chavez's period, there were at least once a year. Some kind of election was taking place at least once a year. It's one of the tactics that Chavez used to also kind of re-energize and highlight the fact that he still very much controlled and was in control and was popular in the country. When it came to non-electoral periods, that's when the opposition really was at its weakest, I would say. And this is what Juan was referring to in terms of, you know, when you would have these opposition actors go out to different countries in the region, to the U.S., Europe, and others, and their messages were not being necessarily the same, et cetera. So, you know, again, this, I think, has been an evolution of the opposition. I think now more than ever, especially as Juan said under Juan Guaido, the interim president now, that has changed. They've been able to coalesce now. Obviously, there's no credible elections left in the country, so they've had to evolve. But that is an important distinction, I think, to just take into consideration. Now, moving into your question, I think that's a great one as well. It is very important, I think, for those interested in Venezuela to know what their respective representatives are saying and what their stances are, if any, on the issue. While, as Juan mentioned, there is large bipartisan support for Venezuela and support for humanitarian crisis, for obviously some of the broader sanctions that the U.S. is placing on Venezuelan officials and governments, there are divisions on exactly what the role of the U.S. should be in Venezuela. I think it is important for each person to educate themselves on what our representatives are saying and see whether personally, you know, one agrees with that. Obviously, Congress plays an important role, and we can't forget that. And so I think that there's a lot that can be done, as with any issue, on this issue as well. Another important thing I think to know is that there is a large Venezuelan diaspora in the U.S. I think as a lot of you may have already heard, you know, Venezuela's failed state has really led to the largest migration crisis in Latin American's history. An estimated 3 million Venezuelans have fled the country since 2015 because of the conditions in the country. A lot of what you all have heard about lack of food, medicine, insecurity, et cetera. So there are now large diaspora groups of Venezuelans throughout Latin America, throughout the U.S., and throughout Europe. In the U.S. in particular, there are large numbers of Venezuelans in Miami, but also in major other cities. And because a lot of these Venezuelans have recently, I would say, left the country, they're very much active and organized in trying to, from there, you know, from where they are and their communities, trying to support some of the bigger issues in Venezuela, particularly with the humanitarian assistance. So they hold humanitarian drives and so forth to be able to send to Venezuela. So I think these are important groups for you know, for folks interested in helping the situation to reach out to identify and then reach out to and see how they can contribute to some of those causes.
So Emilio, maybe I'll turn it to conclude to you and maybe you can share with our listeners here what they can do to really influence, you know, in Venezuela and the path forward. And then we'll turn it over to questions.
Thank you. No, I think that what has been said, it makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, any political pressure that is applied has to be based in facts, has to be based on good information. And people should try to identify organized groups. There are, as Katia said, quite a number of them. Almost, I would say, in every city, every time that the opposition has called for demonstrations, there have been, organized movements in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in New York, Chicago, Miami. So, and, of course, in Europe, it's also very strong organizations. And it's sad that now the concept of diaspora is applied to the Venezuelan people, people who have been, was for most of the 20th century, a net recipient of immigrants rather than source of immigration to other countries. I think, by the way, that the catastrophe that is now going on before our eyes is going to make this even worse. It's going to make it even worse for Colombia, which is the main country that receives the bulk of the first of this wave of migration, and then second place to Brazil. So, but we haven't. If there's nothing done, particularly with the crisis on of electricity and in the supply of water, most places in Caracas have been without direct water for 35 days. And there is no relief in sight. So the catastrophe is it's just difficult to fathom.
Yeah.
So I think of all the pressure that can be affected. I want to just summing up, the name of the main actor in this drama has not been pronounced, and that is Cuba. And it seems to me that it's very difficult to understand how this government, the Maduro government and the military, have been able to withstand in the middle of this catastrophe without understanding what has been the role of the Cuban government. And finally, I think the American government has understood that without putting pressure on the Cuban government, there's not going to be little hope that the government in Venezuela would actually accept any type of change. Fortunately, that has changed. Previous administration was much more interested in the legacy of the president and in trying to be seen as restoring relationship with Obama. With Cuba. Fortunately, this administration has understood the role of Cuba into the oppression of the Venezuelan people, and is taking measures to actually try to make Cuba pay for their actions.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for sharing. I think this was really insightful conversation. So what I'd like to do is we have some questions in the queue. And if you have a question, please, again, dial 5-star on your phone, and you'll be added to the queue. And I'd like to turn it over maybe to my colleague, Lorna, to announce the first caller's name and unmute their line. Lorna, do you want to take over?
Yes, Sylvia, I'm happy to take over. So our first call comes from Kathy in Indianapolis.
Thank you all so much for your time and your insights about Venezuela. I just got back from Colombia about 3 weeks ago, and it's amazing how generous that country has been in accommodating all these immigrants from Venezuela. And they were pointed out to me that many of them are these Grubhub delivery people. And I'm just saying this as an aside. I have a question. But they didn't seem to resent it. They just, you know, felt so sorry for what Venezuela is going through. So my question is, how does Maduro keep in his power? Is he using whatever money is left from either the whatever oil is still being exported, which is not much, and whatever money he's getting from Cuba to pay the military to keep him in power? Because obviously the people want him out. What's happening there?
But I'll offer one answer fairly quickly. Importantly, there is no independent television in Venezuela, and there is no independent printed press, and there is no independent radio. So it's very difficult to organize any coordination of political action across the country. And the government has depended very much on that. By the way, the Cubans are not helping the Venezuelans with money. They are helping them with counterintelligence within the army, that and by offering their expertise in the security of Maduro. So I believe that the reason why there hasn't been a much more sustained movement or insurrection, although there have been attempts mm-hmm. in Maracaibo and in other cities, is because the coordination between the different actors in the different people in the different regions is very, very hard. The cost of the government has actually done a very good job at snuffing any focus of rebellion very, very quickly.
Great.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that a couple of things. First, you know, as you know, Venezuela is going through a crisis right now where, you know, there's nationwide blackouts, lack of food, lack of access to water. These are stresses and impacts that affect everyday Venezuelans. And so it is really hard, I think, to be able to react and take part in any type of action when your primary focus is trying to find food and water for your family. Now, you know, I used to think that the complete collapse of the system in Venezuela was something that Maduro did not want, that he was trying to control. But I actually think I've now grown to my theory, my personal theory, which is that he's actually using this crisis as a control on society, because he knows that if, you know, you're waking up every morning and what you're going to spend your entire day on is trying to identify what store has food for your family, and if you have a sick child, how you can get them the medical attention that they need, or where you're going to get water that is not going to make you sick. You don't have time to do anything else. You don't have time to think of anything else. So I think that's a tactic, again, a hypothesis that I have, that he's using. The other important thing to, I think, keep in mind is that, you know, we talk a lot about Maduro as the one in control, but he is not the only one. And frankly, I think there are some people that would argue that perhaps he's not the one in control at all. What Chavez created and what Maduro, I think, has been reinforcing since he's taken over, power is dividing up the power and ensuring that the military and other other sectors, what I call within this government, are maintained, are satisfied enough to keep him in power. So there's a lot of different interests from a lot of different groups that I think are also making it hard, one, for any change, but also are allowing to a certain degree Maduro to stay in power.
I mean, there's also the angle of, just very briefly, is, China and Russia have loaned billions of dollars to the country. Not a lot is known about how that money has been used, but the treasury is bare, and they're just barely getting by. But there are people in that country, and you'll see that a lot of Venezuelans have lost weight because of the lack of access to food, and yet there are people in the country that are gaining weight, and those are those who have access to dollars and are still profiting. So I think one of the theories of the case that the United States has had is that by eliminating access to currency, that they will, at least force, they're the ideologues that are committed to this vision of whatever it is that is this 21st century socialism. But then there are people that are there for the money. And they think that once that money goes away, that parts of the military will dissent. I think that's a bet. That's an informed bet. But I don't think we know for sure what will happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think we have another question. Lorna, do you want to?
That would be Deborah Pickett. So, Deborah, when you are ready, if you can go ahead and ask your question. I just want to thank all of you. It's been such an interesting program, and I think the Policy Circle did such a great job with your preparation materials, and I also really enjoyed listening to the interview with Angela and Emilio. So, thank you so much. I think this is such an important topic. I think my question is premature, but the question is, so what happens if Maduro does collapse? How do you restore order? How do you rebuild those institutions and restore a sense of legitimacy? What does that look like, and what kind of role would the United States play in supporting that transition?
Oh,
that's an excellent question. May I take that one? Sorry.
So
I think that's an excellent question. And first I would say is that, there was a question on how the Policy Circle can get involved politically. I think a lot of people don't know that, huge U.S. initiatives like Plan Colombia that helped transform Colombia were actually driven by MAD, Mothers Against Drugs, who, were calling for a political response. And so I think whether it's pressuring your representatives on the left, on the right to be engaged on this issue, I think the policy circle can be a very powerful force. But what I would say is that if all of a sudden Maduro gets on a plane tomorrow and goes to Cuba to retire, the problem hasn't gone away. I think we have Venezuela has gone from being one of the most prosperous countries in the hemisphere to almost being in a situation like Haiti, where institutions, infrastructure, the role of the private sector, everything, you name it, has to start from scratch. Not only that, but there are hundreds of thousands of armed militia that the government has empowered to try to enforce their order. And then there are even the presence of cartels and illegal armed groups in the country. So I think the first thing is addressing the security situation on the ground and making sure that there's stability. The second one is that there's a massive humanitarian challenge. And I think if you, Katya mentioned 3 million people that have left the country by the end of this year, the Venezuelan migration crisis will be greater than that of Syria. And if you think about it, the international community provided $30 billion to help address the situation in Syria. For Venezuela, it's only been a couple hundred million dollars. So I think the U.S. government and the international can lead, and the international community should really be stepping up to help address this humanitarian situation. And then beyond that, you have this huge need to rebuild the economy. And because the United States has a very important leadership role to play globally, but particularly with regards to our neighbors, we should be the first country to line up and to make sure that we are helping rebuild the oil industry, though that'll take a decade and hundreds of billions of dollars, help rebuild the agricultural industry, which will also take a long time and a lot of money, rebuild the infrastructure. And it can do that not just by doling out foreign assistance. There is an important role here for the U.S. private sector to play, and there are incentives that the United States can provide. So the U.S. can eliminate sanctions, the sanctions regime via presidential determination, and it can create incentives and guarantees so that companies that want to invest in the rebuilding of Venezuela can be there. But the most important thing, and I'll finish with this, is you have a country that now owes $150 billion. So this regime, to ensure its survival, has mortgaged future generations to China, Russia, and other bondholders. The United States should be trying to lead a conversation on how to manage the debt that Venezuela has to handle. And then the most important point is that anything that the United States does to help rebuild Venezuela, which will take decades, and so just because Maduro leaves doesn't mean that we can declare victory, it should be something that needs to be led by the Venezuelan people. So it should be something that we lead toward the country toward an election that is verifiable and allows the Venezuelan people to determine their future. And whatever is the next government, the international community should be following their lead on how to actually help rebuild the country. But this is something that is going to affect Venezuelans, it's going to affect Latin America, and also going to require U.S. engagement to be sustained for a very long time.
Well, thank you so much, Juan, for these closing remarks. I think this has been such an interesting conversation, and a lot of insights were shared here that we will capture in an email and send it out to everyone who participated. So I want to thank you, Juan and Katia and Emilio, for joining us today. And shortly, everyone on the call will receive an email with a link to an audio of this conversation, as well as, again, a link to Angela's interview with Emilio. And we'd like to encourage you to share these links with anyone who you think might be interested in the issue, your representatives, and other women who might be interested in starting a policy circle. And finally, I'd like to remind everyone that registration is now open for the Policy Circle Leadership Summit that will be in Chicago, November 14 and 15, and you can go to our website to register. So thank you again. Thank you guys for participating.